The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Last week, I began a novella by Joyce Carol Oates, The Bicycle Accident, published in the April 27th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine. And this week, I will read the second half of it. The Bicycle Accident by Joyce Carol Oates. In high school, Evie's grades were erratic, unpredictable. Her enthusiasms, like her hatreds, came in surges and faded. She rarely spoke of her teachers except with derision. She had lost, it seemed, her ability to skim pages of homework, to assimilate what was essential. But she loved the sketchbook that Arlette had purchased for her. When the pages ran out, Arlette purchased another. In this sketchbook, Evie drew penguin-like figures with broken feet and gaping, toothless mouths, lurching about like drunken persons. Tirelessly, she drew humanoid figures, clownish, missing parts of their bodies. Her self-portraits were crude, cruel. She gave herself a pimply, blemished face with staring, blank eyes. She began to stay after school, involved with the school newspaper. Proudly, she showed her family a feature in the paper titled EVI. The joke is, the evil eye is meant to ward off evil spirits, but see, in my cartoons, I am the evil spirit. That's the joke. Kevin frowned at the comic strip, clearly didn't know what to think, and wasn't sure that he approved. Arlette stared, smiling, for a mother must always smile. Gosh, honey, this is so professional. Her daughter had an undeniable talent for caricature, which meant cruelty with a comic twist, or comedy with a cruel twist. Were these caricatures of actual people at school, Arlette wondered? Classmates of Evie's? Teachers? Or were they just generic figures, foolish, self-important, vain, obese, or skeletal thin, with spindly legs and bumpy breasts, stalk-like necks? One of the females, fat lips, jowly cheeks, insipid little smile, seemed to resemble Arlette herself. And there was the loathsome hog with an ugly snout face, features so cleverly arranged that they suggested unmistakably Rob Nash. Though Kevin didn't seem to recognize his old friend, staring at the hog caricature, trying to see how it might be innocently funny. Is this? Who? The school principal? Arlette would have winced, except she knew that Evie was watching her face closely. This is wonderful, Evie, like a comic strip in the newspaper. Your teachers must be so impressed. Evie laughed, delighted. More likely they're afraid they're next. Months later, the news came that Rob Nash had passed away of lung cancer. It had been known in Strikersville that he had been ill for some time, undergoing chemotherapy. Arlette and Kevin had visited him in the hospital several times. Heartbreaking how Rob Nash had changed. His face had thinned like a balloon that has lost air. There was little joking or banter. He squinted at Arlette and Kevin as if he didn't exactly remember them, the middle-aged couple who'd brought to his flower-festooned hospital room a potted African violet wrapped in tinfoil. From somewhere, relatives of Rob Nash had appeared overnight, taking up much of the space in his hospital room and then in his hospice room. As Strikersville's friends of Rob Nash observed cynically, they were like vultures coming home to roost. But would Rob Nash alter his will for these strangers? Or was it too late? Neither Kevin nor Arlette spoke of it, the will. When Arlette told Evie that Rob Nash had passed away, she had a little reaction. Who? What do you mean, who? You know who Rob Nash is, was. Arlette felt such dismay, sorrow, exasperation with Evie. Seeing the peevish expression on her daughter's face, she burst into tears. The poor man, poor Rob, he was such a loving friend. Meanly, Evie laughed. It was an emotional time for Arlette. Really, she'd loved Rob Nash, as Rob Nash had loved her. No one would look at Arlette again in quite that way. That special way of his. Kevin was grieving, too, in his stiff, silent way that suggested a deep unease as well as loss. Where Rob Nash's money had gone, how much his estate was worth at the time of his death, no one seemed to know. Maybe he hadn't had as much money as people had thought, as he'd led people to think. That began to be the word around town. With the excuse of emptying Evie's wastebasket, changing her sheets, Arlette discovered in a drawer in Evie's desk some very ugly, obscene Japanese comic books. Schoolgirls in school uniforms doing disgusting things to old Japanese men. Graphic novels, picture books, YA novels with lurid covers. Elsewhere in the room, she found pages torn from Evie's sketchbook. Naked cartoon figures, girls, women, adolescent boys. Some were kissing and touching one another inappropriately. And others were fighting with knives or swords or undergoing horrific tortures, beheadings, dissections. Breasts hacked off, intestines dragged out of abdomens. Most ghastly, a fetus torn from a woman's belly. A smug, smiling, fattish woman with Arlette's face and the caption, "Momster." Arlette was shocked, sickened. It was clear to her. Arvy had fallen under the spell of someone at school. Her homeroom teacher? An unmarried woman with hair trimmed so short it was practically a crew cut? Evie had mentioned this homeroom teacher several times, not mockingly, as she tended to speak of her other teachers, but rather admiringly. Without speaking to Evie, who would never tell her the truth and would just try to prevent her, Arlette drove to the high school. Classes were still in session. It was mid-afternoon. In the assistant principal's office, Arlette spoke forcefully, angrily. She brought Evie's drawings with her as evidence. A lesbian teacher on the Strikersville faculty, corrupting children. Her daughter had survived a traumatic accident just 2 years before at the age of 13. She hadn't fully recovered. She was impressionable, naive, just the sort of child to be groomed by a perverted adult. Soon Arlette was speaking with the principal as well. Others on the staff were summoned, including, finally, the homeroom teacher, who professed utter astonishment at Arlette's charges and claimed scarcely to know Evie Hansen and declined to confirm that she was or was not a lesbian. By this time, Arlette was sincerely upset. The sound of her own voice, high-pitched, quavering with indignation, roused her to further excitement. The more calmly the other spoke, the more upset Arlette became. She threatened to go to the media. She threatened to call the police, a lawyer. At the same time, she didn't want her daughter to be personally involved. Evie's too sensitive. She had a brain fracture. She almost died. I just need to know that she's protected here at school. We need to know, her father and me. Though, involving Kevin was the last thing that Arlette wanted. Any kind of fuss that might have a public aspect to it, anything that might get into the newspapers and be bad for business, Kevin would not wish to be involved in. Following this incident, Evie was transferred to a different homeroom. The teacher was not fired, to Arlette's disappointment, nor even suspended from teaching, but allowed to complete the school term. She then transferred to another school in the district. Of course, Evie soon learned what had happened. She was humiliated, furious. She refused to speak to Arlette, even to remain for very long in a room with her. She accused her mother of ruining her life, a life that she had already ruined once. Evie began skipping classes, skipping school altogether. She stayed away overnight, over an entire weekend. She was spending time with a new friend, a girl who'd graduated from Strikersville High several years before and now was working at the Target store at the mall. She left messages on Arlette's answering machine. "I'm okay. I'm not going to hurt myself. You have done that for me. You can't bring me back in chains. I will return when I am ready. This is my own life needing to be saved." Very little they could do. The Strikersville police listened patiently but never did a thing. A runaway is not a top priority in Strikersville in the way that an abduction or a kidnapping would have been. It was pointed out that Evie had voluntarily left home and was still attending school, in fact. Not every day, but frequently. There was no evidence that she was being held against her will, and there was no reason to think that she wouldn't return home. Most runaways did, fairly soon. Indeed, Evie did return home sometimes when she wasn't with J.D. or with Carol, Ernie, Smithy. When she was home, she barricaded herself in her room. She avoided the family at mealtimes. She cultivated a sidelong sneer, a sneer of cutting indifference. Arlette was stricken to the heart. Unnerving how, if you smile at another person and that person does not smile back, you feel annihilated, as if your reflection in the mirror had vanished. Evie was well aware of social cues, Arlette thought. She just refused to participate in them. Like playing a game with no intention of following the rules, laughing at fools who followed the rules. Inquiring of her father, "How are things at Ace Hardware, Dad?" as if the name of the store were quaint, amusing. At 17, she dropped out of school to live with new friends in Rochester, and then in Niagara Falls, where she worked at a farmer's market. She sent a photo of herself in oversized bib overalls, grinning with her perfect plastic teeth, beside a giant, deformed pumpkin that had been carved for Halloween. Having a great time, working the earth, earning $3 signs. When Arlette called the number that she had for Evie to invite her home for Thanksgiving, she was told that Evie had left, gone to Illinois, with plans to work on an organic farm there. Evie was in the wind. She'd wanted them to know, but she would check back in when she could. It was months before they heard from her again, and then just a hurried call. "I told you there's nothing to worry about. No big deal. I'm going to hang up if you start crying, Mom. I will not be emotionally blackmailed." A postcard from Denver, the Rocky Mountains, in Dago colors, a hastily scrawled note, barely decipherable except for, "Be well, love you, E." Postcards from El Paso, Albuquerque, Los Angeles, Shasta, California. It was believed in Strikersville that Evie Hansen had gone off to college somewhere distant. As, in time, Billy went to the State University at Plattsburgh by the Canadian border to study computer science. Roy enlisted in the Army and was away for several years before returning to work at Ace Hardware until Kevin retired early for health reasons, and Roy took over the store. "Because I died once, I am not afraid to die again. Because death is all around us and in the air we breathe. Because death is in the soil. I love to sink my hands into the soil. I love to dirty my face. In the ambulance, I saw my soul fly out of my mouth like smoke. In the ambulance, my soul returned to me, but it was not the same. When you came to see me in the hospital, it was too late. I had died then and was not your daughter. The cord had been broken. You never understood. What you believe to be family is just an accident. There is no meaning in accident." The envelope from Evie was postmarked Traverse City, Michigan. Inside was a thick swath of handwritten pages. Arlette wiped at her eyes as she read the letter, passing the pages to Kevin, who was having difficulty reading with his bifocals. The handwriting was slanted, urgent, in purple ink. It might have been a stranger's. She could hear nothing of Evie's voice in the shrill tone of the letter. It had been how many years since they'd last seen their daughter? Evie would be in her late 30s now. Arlette had a difficult time imagining any age for her at all. Kevin said irritably, "Can you read this? Chicken scrawling? Do you want me to read it aloud?" "Don't bother." "Kevin!" "Oh, all right, go ahead." Arlette read slowly with difficulty. It seemed to her that Evie was talking to herself, and the margins of the letter were small, grotesque cartoon faces. Arlette wondered if Evie was right, that family was just an accident. There'd never been any connection between any of them, and Evie, thrown violently from her bicycle at 13, was the only one to perceive this. She isn't herself, Kevin. Whoever wrote this, it isn't Evie.
Well, who is it then? Christ!
Kevin spoke in disgust, knocking the pages from Arlette's fingers to flutter and fall to the floor. 3 weeks after Kevin died and his obituary appeared in the Strikersville Gazette, a call came to Arlette from Evie, living now in Bolton Landing in the Adirondacks, about 300 miles east. Kevin had been just 63 when he died of a sudden heart attack. Arlette was 61. Not old at all. When she heard her daughter's voice, Arlette's first thought came in a rush of hope. She will come home now. She will live with me now. In an agitated voice, Evie was demanding to know when exactly Kevin had died. Had there been any warning? When was the funeral? Where was he buried? Where were Roy and Billy? Had they come to the funeral? In the background was a muffled cacophony of voices, as if Evie were making the call in a large room or hall. From what Arlette could gather, Evie was in communication with someone in Strikersville who kept her posted on the latest hometown news. You still live in the same house, Mom? How will I know where you live? Of course I live in the same house. It's the same tacky little ranch house, right? With the aluminum siding. Are you in Strikersville? Look out the window, Mom! Arlette hurried to a living room window facing the road. She could see nothing out of the ordinary. Are you here in Strikersville, Evie? Maybe I'm driving around the block. Maybe I'm stalking you, Mom. Arlette ran outside into a wintry November wind. Evie! Hello! Arlette cried into the phone receiver, which had lost its connection so far from the house. At the roadway, Arlette stood shivering convulsively, looking first in one direction, then in the other. Her heart was beating rapidly with expectation. My daughter! My daughter! An approaching station wagon slowed to a halt. Hello? Is it Arlette? Mrs. Handsome? Is something wrong? Arlette recognized a neighbor. In her excitement, she couldn't have said the woman's name. I think my daughter is back, Evie. She's somewhere close by. Your daughter? The one who went away to college? Yes, Evie. Arlette stood in the middle of the road, disheveled and confused, her eyes brimmed with tears from the cold wind. In a kindly voice, the neighbor was asking her if she wanted to be driven anywhere, if she had any idea where Evie was. Distractedly, Arlette shook her head, adding, to be polite, No, thank you. She's probably on her own. I'll just wait for her. You could wait inside the house, Mrs. Hansen. She'll know where to find you. Yes, yes, that's so. Arlette turned away as if she were going back inside the house. The neighbor waved to her, driving away, but Arlette remained at the end of the driveway in the whipping November wind. Feeling absurdly gratified that this was how Evie was described locally, the one who went away to college. At Pheasant Ridge, where Arlette went to live after the house on Post Road was sold, there was altogether too much conversation about health issues. Damned if she would participate. She had better things to talk about. Most residents at Pheasant Ridge were widows. Most residents had known one another in their former lives, some as long ago as high school, elementary school. Regrouping now, those who remained, those who'd survived marriage, children. No self-pity. She wasn't one of those who fretted, wept, moaned that their children or grandchildren failed to visit them as often as they wanted. Though Arlette was beset by health issues of her own, osteoporosis, hollowing out her bones, bronchitis that left her breathless and weak, an upper row of abscessed teeth needing to be removed and replaced by expensive dentures, not covered by insurance, glaucoma controlled by nightly eye drops, alarming memory lapses like cuts in a defective film. Gin Rummy, book club, square dancing, graceless, bouncy, joyful, all-female laughter and panting. 3 mornings a week, swimming slowly in the turquoise-tinted pool that smelled ice-smartingly of chlorine. Arlette did have visitors, relatives. Her niece Cassie came to visit every few weeks, fondly recalling, "That barbecue you and Uncle Kevin gave for us, that was so kind of you." It wasn't a barbecue, just a cold buffet, as lavish as Arlette could make it, but Arlette was grateful for the memory and did not correct her niece. "And poor Evie had that accident on the bridge on her bicycle. That was a close call." For a moment, Arlette couldn't comprehend what the words meant, a close call. Realizing then that Evie hadn't died, that was the close call for which she and Kevin had been so grateful at the time. "Evie called me, you know, after Kevin died." "Yes, you told me, Aunt Arlette. That was nice of her. She was coming to visit, but something happened. She had to postpone." And then one afternoon, on the eve of Arlette's 70th birthday, in fact, Evie came to visit her in Pheasant Ridge, unannounced. "Mom, hey, it's me, Evie." In the doorway of Arlette's room, an individual with a weathered face, squinting pale blue eyes, slouching shoulders, of no evident age, except not young, head shaved and stubbly, glaring piercings in her face. She wore much laundered jeans, corroded white along the seams, a synthetic snakeskin jacket, lace-up boots. The plastic teeth looked less white and shiny. Lines bracketed the thin-lipped mouth that ventured a hesitant smile. Arlette stared, astonished. She burst into tears. "Her daughter, Evie, come here, come here, give me a hug, come here." Arlette tried to stand, grew dizzy, and fell back into the chintz easy chair that was soft and boneless, fitted to the contours of her body. Evie, embarrassed, came to her, limping just perceptibly, breathing hard as if she'd been running. Her breath smelled ashy, stale. Evie explained that she'd happened to hear that Arlette was in this place, which hadn't existed when she was living in Strikersville. All there was here on this road was fields and trees past the high school. Evie spoke awkwardly, like one not accustomed to speech. She stared at Arlette, blinking as if she saw something that frightened her and thus provoked her to smile inanely and chatter.
"So good to see you, Evie. What a lovely surprise. Please, can you stay? We can have dinner together."
Evie muttered something inaudible, apologetic, shrugging her shoulders in the old way that Arlette recalled with a pang of regret. What was she doing now? Well, she was between gigs. Probably she was going to stay with her friends in Michigan if she could pin them down on dates. Right now, she was taking a road trip, a break. In Bolton's Landing, she'd had time to devote to her art, her cartoon art. Proudly, Evie drew out of her backpack what appeared to be an unusually thick comic book, titled B-Word Storm Warnings, a collection of women's cartoons in which work by E. Hansen was included. She'd acquired a national reputation, finally, Evie said. She posted her cartoons online. She had subscribers. She'd been teaching at Adirondack Community College, the art of the cartoon.
"Have you? Teaching? Your father would be so impressed."
"Yeah, well, that's okay." After a few minutes, Evie fell silent, as if she'd run out of news. She was sitting on a chair now, facing Arlette, her back to the door, which was just slightly ajar. Arlette tried to think of more questions to ask, things to tell Evie. She didn't want to appear anxious. As long as she kept talking, Evie wouldn't leave, would she? Asking Evie for the second or third time if she'd like to stay for dinner in the dining room. Early dinner, 5 p.m. It was just 3:40 now. Evie replied evasively, "Yeah, maybe, okay." Evie asked after Roy and Billy and Cassie. Asking then, as if she'd only just thought of it, whether Arlette and Kevin had ever inherited anything from that friend of theirs, You wanted us to call him Uncle Rob? Rob Nash. Arlette had not spoken the name aloud in many years. But hadn't Rob Nash passed away before Evie had left home? Wouldn't Evie already know the answer to her question? Arlette couldn't remember exactly. She felt a stab of loss and chagrin, the loss of a dear friend and the loss of the bequest that Kevin had believed they would receive from Rob Nash. When the will was read, Arlette and Kevin were not even present. No one had notified them. Families close in upon themselves when there is a death, especially, Arlette had come to understand, when it is the death of someone with a sizable estate. Still, Rob Nash must have canceled a debt of Kevin's, a $30,000 loan he'd made to Ace Hardware. Kevin had always intended to repay the loan, but when Rob died, no one contacted Kevin about it. Apparently, there wasn't a record of it in Rob Nash's accounts. Kevin hadn't shared much with Arlette. He hadn't wanted his wife to know that Ace Hardware had required a loan. Evasively, Arlette told Evie no, she didn't think so. She didn't think there had been any inheritance from Rob Nash that she could recall. Arlette spoke earnestly, apologetically. Conversational subjects seemed to shift away from her as if she were reaching for a balloon that eluded her. She could see it. She could see what she meant to say, but she lost concentration. "So it was all for nothing?" Evie spoke not accusingly, but with a sense of wonder. "What was nothing? I can't hear you so well, Evie." "I said, it was all for nothing then? That's what I said." Tears welled in Evie's pale eyes of sorrow or anger or bafflement. Arlette could not have said. On Evie's knobby right wrist, a smudged tattoo of a bird with wide-flung wings and a sharp beak in profile. Arlette wasn't sure what the subject was, what Evie had been asking. She had to be careful not to agree too readily. In Pheasant Ridge, the predilection was to nod yes, yes, like a yo-yo, Arlette had noticed. A number of the residents were stone deaf but eager to please, which resulted in misunderstandings. Arlette told Evie that Roy was managing the hardware store now, still at the mall, same place. Billy had some sort of computer consultant job in Albany. He was what's called a computer whiz. He hadn't gotten married. Roy had, but was separated. No children. Evie shrugged. Her leathery face betrayed no more emotion than if she'd been hearing news over the radio. "Your father left me the house, you know, and the land, and some part of the hardware store, and the rest of it to Roy. I think that's what it was. He left something for Billy, too. Not much. There isn't much. I don't remember the details. You know, your dad didn't want to worry me with money matters. We didn't know where you were, Evie." Arlette spoke slowly, as if groping her way. Evie shrugged, her face darkening. If she was hurt or angry, Arlette couldn't judge. Her vision wasn't so good anymore, like her hearing. The fact was, Kevin hadn't spoken of Evie in the years before he died. He seemed to forget that they had a daughter. Before that, he'd been furious with her. The disrespect, he called it. In the awkward silence, Arlette heard herself say guiltily, "There is some money, Evie. I set it aside for you. In my bank account. I knew that you would come back. I knew it. It isn't much, I'm afraid. I'm using more of it than I expected in this place. There are all kinds of hidden charges and fees, but I could make out a check." "Could you, Mom? That would be very generous." Evie was looking embarrassed, swiping at her nose with the back of her hand like an uncomfortable child. Arlette gave instructions to Evie to look for her checkbook, which was where? In a drawer? Evie brought it to Arlette with a ballpoint pen from her backpack, and Arlette fretted over a blank check, uncertain how much to give to her daughter. She could afford to give Evie $500, or was it $5,000? $15,000? She smiled. Kevin used to tease her about being confused by zeros. Evie said, I can fill in the number, Mom. You just have to sign the check. Pressing the palm of her hand against the edge of the table to prevent trembling, Arlette signed the check. Arlette B. Hansen. How lonely this was. She was Mrs. Hansen, but there was no Mr. Hansen. Thanks, Mom. Gosh, you are very generous. I remember how people always said you were generous. God bless you. Evie's face was flushed now. She'd become elated, animated. She ripped the check out of the book, folded it neatly, and slipped it into a pocket of the snakeskin jacket. Arlette, too, was moved. God bless you. Whether it was sincere or some sort of Evie mockery, Arlette wasn't going to fret over it. Someone had advised her once. She thought it was Rob Nash. Don't look too closely into the motives of the people in your life. He'd laugh then, his gut laugh, which had been so infectious. She sits together with her daughter as dusk deepens outside the window. Neither makes a move to turn on a light, as if a spell would be broken. As years ago, they gazed out the window of the TV room where Evie's hospital bed was positioned, into the distance of the foothills. Here there is a parking lot, but beyond the parking lot, an uncultivated field and hills stretching out of sight to the Chautauqua Mountains. Overcast sky like slept-in bedclothes. Comfortable, soft, laundered. Are they waiting for dinner, Arlette and her visitor? The summons to dinner at 5 p.m.? In her elated state, Evie is humming, sketch pad on her knees as she rapidly draws a likeness of Arlette in the chintz easy chair, her Chanel bathrobe loose about her thin arms and chest. Arlette seems to have been exhausted by the intense conversation to which she isn't accustomed. Her mouth has become slack, spittle gleaming at the corners of her lips. She'd have rubbed her pale coral lipstick onto her lips if she'd known that a visitor was coming, but she'd had no warning. As her pencil moves, Evie observes her subject closely. Arlette seems not elderly, but soft-boned, tentative, smaller than Evie recalls. For there was a time when Arlette was taller than Evie, of course. Evie had been Mommy's little helper in the kitchen. No choice but to help Mommy. Evie has noticed that Arlette seems to have new teeth, artificial teeth resembling her own but shinier, whiter. On her thick, booted feet now, Evie hovers over Arlette as if deliberating whether to kiss her mother goodbye. For Evie has decided to leave. Suddenly, she is in a hurry to leave. It is often like that with Evie. Her blood begins to pump quickly. She seems about to kiss the soft, creased cheek. Instead, as if impulsively yet unerringly, Evie's fingers grope their way into Arlette's mouth, gently dislodge the dentures, and remove them without waking Arlette. She slips them into a pocket and backs away then, snatching up her backpack and leaving the room. Alone in the room, Arlette awakes, confused, not sure what has happened. Why did the nurse take away her dentures? She's not at the dentist. She knows that. She's in her own room at Pheasant Ridge. She has not been at the dentist's office in quite a while. Arlette calls out, "Hello? Hello?" Her mouth feels wrong. Her tongue is too big, and she can feel her gums with it. She calls and calls, "Hello? Hello?" Her voice rising in distress and alarm until at last someone enters the room and switches on the overhead light. A short, stout girl in a white nylon tunic and trousers, asking in a vexed voice, "Yes, ma'am, what's the problem now?" From the September 25th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The New Yorker Interview of Joyce Carol Oates by Katie Waldman. The author Joyce Carol Oates is best known for being one of the country's preeminent fiction writers. She is second best known for being prolific. She is third best known for posting unfiltered, helter-skelter, and occasionally baffling thoughts on Twitter a platform on which she has achieved unexpected late career notoriety. In August, Oates published Babysitter, her latest novel, which joins a towering stack of poetry, essays, criticism, and short stories, including the much anthologized Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? Ripped partly from the headlines of 1970s Detroit, Babysitter follows a sheltered and perfumed housewife who begins an affair with a man she knows only as YK. Meanwhile, a serial killer is on the loose, gruesomely murdering children. The book returns to and reconfigures some of Oates' predominant psychological themes, the messiness of desire, the shame of pleasure, as well as some of her predominant social themes, violence against women, the essentializing prisons of race and class. The past few years have not been gentle with Oates. In 2019, her second husband, the neuroscientist Charles Gross, died. 11 years prior, she'd lost her first husband, the editor Raymond J. Smith, after he contracted pneumonia, an experience she wrote about in her first memoir, A Widow's Story. When I caught up with the author in mid-September, she was juggling her fall teaching load. She is the Roger S. Berland 52 professor in the humanities emerita at Princeton, is also teaching at Rutgers. Her daily writing practice, she devotes between 5 and 10 hours per day to her craft, and interviews about Babysitters and Blonde. We discuss the appeal of underdogs, the smell of piano keys, and the vagaries of having one's work adapted for the screen. We also tussled over autofiction and the mythic male and female. Our conversation has been edited for length and clarity. Question. I was just thinking about Marilyn Monroe and about Hannah, the rich, elegant blonde in Babysitter, your most recent novel. Some of your most iconic creations, Connie, in Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? Iris in Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart, have been seemingly pure blonde women threatened by spoilage. Would you agree that this is a theme? And if so, why do you find it alluring? A theme in my writing or generally? Your writing. Oh, no. I've written many, many, many novels and short stories. You've just singled out the ones you're asking about. You've talked about 3 or 4 titles that are about blonde women, but I've written, let's say, 1,500 stories. It's tautological, your question. Each project that I work on is fairly independent of the others. But those characters are so evocative. I assume they must have held a special fascination for you. Well, it's hard to say. If you are a writer or an artist, each project you work on is actually very special and challenging. Each project exerts its own challenges and its own gravitas. I'm probably drawn to writing about relative underdogs or people who've been marginalized or impoverished or disenfranchised. They don't have to be blonde girls or women. They could also be men. I've written about boxing, which is an analog, I think, with the whole drama of the iconography of Marilyn Monroe and the other women who were starlets in those days, the late 1940s and 1950s, an analog with boxers who were also exploited. These are working-class Americans who had no unions to protect them. Certainly, Norma Jean Baker was one of hundreds of thousands of starlets who were exploited by the studio system, by male producers and directors, and by Hollywood people. She wasn't like Elizabeth Taylor, who came from a different class in society. She didn't have the protection of a family. Her mother was often institutionalized. She was like a girl in a fairy tale, and she had to make her own way. She was working in an aircraft factory when she was only about 16, and she was doing the kind of work where she was breathing in fumes. If she'd stayed working at that factory for long, she might have gotten some illness. Had Norma Jean Baker not become a starlet and then become Marilyn Monroe, she would have been used up by the world of capitalism. Maybe she wouldn't have lived long. That's what I'm drawn to, more than there being a blonde woman. I've also written about Mike Tyson and other boxers who've had similar experiences. That connection is probably a little closer to what I'm interested in. Well, you told your biographer that you were inspired to write Blonde after seeing a photo of the 17-year-old Norma Jean. You said that this young, hopefully smiling girl, so very American, reminded me powerfully of girls of my childhood, some of them from broken homes. Could you say more about what these girls were like and how you knew them?
Well, I came from upstate New York, western New York, north of Buffalo. It was not a very prosperous community. There were broken homes, families where the father was an alcoholic, and there was a good deal of brutality. My family was actually quite unusual. We, my parents and my brother and I, lived with my mother's parents, so we had a multi-generational farmhouse and more stability. But I went to school with these other girls who were often victimized. Their fathers may have been drinking, or they may have been ill, or they abandoned the family. Norma Jean Baker is one of those girls.
Well, I hope I'm not cherry-picking, but I did notice a kind of familial archetype in many of your books. Remote dads, involved, ambivalent moms, siblings who don't necessarily get along. Do those dynamics resonate with your own experience?
A writer holds a mirror up to life, so I'm writing about life in America. I don't think anything that writers do should be reduced to just their own families. Say somebody is writing about war or the Holocaust. It's not related to their own family. It's basically something that's in the world. We are dramatizing it, holding it up for others to examine. I've written so many books, I certainly exhausted my own life long ago.
You've written that you inherited your father's musical temperament, if not his musical talents. It made me curious about the role of music in your writing.
Well, music is very important to me. I love to hear music, and I'm very drawn to piano music. I have a sort of romantic, emotional attachment to the piano. Even smelling the piano keys, just touching them, depressing a chord. It has a lot of emotional resonance with me. But with my writing, there's a kind of mediated voice. I try for the music of different people's voices. The voices change from person to person. I spend a lot of my time hearing music in my head or singing to myself, the way people sometimes do.
The music of different people's voices. In some ways, I feel like the music in your work is the voice of mass culture. You weave in lyrics from pop songs. I'm thinking particularly of Where Are You Going and Blonde.
The other night I saw the movie Elvis, which is relatively new. It harkens back to a time in our culture in the 1950s when there was a new music, a black-influenced music from the South making its way nationally. It was perceived to be insidious and un-American. Segregationists and white supremacists were very upset at what they called this black music that was making its way. And Elvis Presley was the conduit. He was the liaison. He was singing songs and making music and also, in his live performance, doing moves with his body that he had seen black musicians do. Most white audience had never seen those moves. That's basically the theme, that Elvis represented a kind of pagan break with staid Christian culture. There was the white middle class being besieged by a black wave of rhythm and blues. Have you seen that movie?
I haven't, no.
Well, I don't think that it's a perfect movie, but I do remember that rock and roll and rhythm and blues was considered a war on decency. Preachers and priests were giving sermons against this music. It was a clear generational break. When I wrote Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been in the 1960s, young teenagers were in thrall to music, to rock and roll music.
The music feels disruptive or subversive in your story. Reminded of other elements of your style, all the italics and parentheses and cascading repetition. And thematically, your novels can be pretty violent and extreme. There's graphic rape, murder, child abuse.
Do you find yourself drawn to excess? Well, I'm writing about America. I'm holding a mirror up to reality. The writer or the artist is in control of the frame. There's a frame around the mirror. There's a frame around a novel. It's not infinite. You're selecting and limiting and presenting a certain vision. For instance, Shakespeare is drawn to tragedy. The comedies are wonderful, but it's the tragedies that are profound and always about violence. There is no tragedy as a genre without violence. People who write detective or mystery novels, of course they're drawn to murder because murder is the ultimate crime. What do you make of contemporary literature? Do you think we're valuing the right things?
Are you? Did you really ask me what I think of contemporary literature? That's a question? Oh, I can narrow it a bit. What do I think of contemporary life? What do I think of the 20th century or the medieval period? That's an insanely vast question. Well, I wondered whether there were particular trends that you liked or disliked. I was thinking of your tweet from March of 2021. You were talking about autofiction, which blurs the line between a novel and an author's memoir or journal. You wrote, quote, "Strange to have come of age reading great novels of ambition, substance, and imagination, Dostoevsky, Wolfe, Joyce, Faulkner, and now find yourself praised and acclaimed for one little husk of autofiction with space between paragraphs to make the book seem longer," end quote. Yes, I was thinking if you were a writer and, say, in your 20s or 30s, and you had studied these great works in university, but then you yourself are writing something relatively short and not very ambitious, how strange it would be, you know, to be praised for what you were doing when you would know, of course, that you're nothing like Toni Morrison or William Faulkner. But all my tweets are very ephemeral. This one was written after I had been a judge for the Ansfield Wolf Awards. Do you know what the Ansfield Wolf Awards are? No, what are they? Oh, that's so sad. You've never heard of it. Well, they consider it to be the Black Pulitzer. The awards are given to writing that deals with race, particularly in America. Percival Everett was our prize winner in 2022. He was my nomination. He writes about lynching in America. Really profound writing. So when I was contrasting that to autofiction, it just seems so extraordinary that you have a body of writing about subjects of great tragic and political significance set beside these very autobiographical minimalist works of fiction. It's not that I care. I don't care what people write. I encourage my students to write out of their strength. So if they're really strong in writing about themselves and confessional memoirist work, then that's what they should do. But taking a broad view, I guess, I admire work by Percival Everett and John Edgar Wideman a little more than work about easier subjects. So, to clarify what constitutes ambition, it's a social, not an individual lens? Well, we can say, for instance, that Middlemarch is a very ambitious novel. There had never been a novel quite like it before. There had been novels, of course, before that, more entertaining novels or novels that were didactic, but George Eliot brings everything together, and Toni Morrison's novels are ambitious. They're not necessarily long. Toni was writing in a distilled way, a poetic way, but she wasn't just writing about herself or something that happened to her. There's a scope, a sense of history. Babysitter spends a lot of time on Hannah's self-loathing and her petty anxieties and vanities. There's some overlap between her psychological portrayal and the way that autofiction narrators present themselves. I don't understand your question. We're drawing a distinction between a kind of grand literary sweep and the small-minded concerns of the self, but I guess I'm saying that I appreciate when your characters have inner lives. Well, Hannah is having experiences that are particularly relevant to the Detroit of that time, to the racial tensions and paradoxes of living in a big American city. I had lived in Detroit myself with my husband. I had friends who lived in the suburbs. It was a time when white residents were fleeing. Babysitter, the real serial killer, was a white man, but it was thought that he could have been a black man preying on white children. White people thought that, wrongly. Their racial animosity was not borne out by reality. You've said that you're not sure that you have a self, a personality. What did you mean? Well, I think most people don't have strong personalities in themselves. Much of what we present to the world is in response to the people around us. I guess it could be called role-playing. In visual art, the personal self thins out. The great canvases by Mark Rothko don't seem to have any residue of a person. They're shimmering. They're just phenomenal. Such exquisite, subtle beauty. Well, your writing is full of indeterminacy and irresolution. It's lifelike in that way, but its complexity, to me, is less on the level of individual characters and more about something deeper, which you've sometimes called the impersonal. Could you talk more about that? Well, I'm drawn to impersonal or transpersonal experiences, life and death. People describe these experiences in archetypal ways that all sound alike. giving birth, which I've never done. That's another transpersonal experience that many people have had. I'm interested in the mystery of personality, how our personalities arise, and then how they fade. Well, your work has explored a specifically female experience of marriage and widowhood, the meaning that women attach to men, their husbands, their homes, and what happens when those things fall away. Whenever we lose somebody very close to us, it could be a parent, a spouse, a sister, or a brother, that violent, visceral loss is difficult to talk about. People don't know what to say. People lose their dogs and cats and they suddenly collapse. They keep seeing the animal around the house. There's that element of loss that is visceral and not amenable to rationality. The closer you are to someone when you lose that person, the more your own personality is shocked. It's like getting hit over the head with a hammer. Grief isn't an idea. It's actually something like an illness. It's an interior loss that you probably never get over. I know people who lost a parent when they were children and feel like they're not whole. In your work, we meet characters whose vulnerabilities we feel, their failures, and their losses. But you also seem to have thought deeply about resilience. For instance, I loved your line from The Lost Landscape about, quote, rejoicing in our elusive catness, end quote. What did you mean by that? Cats can keep going. A cat can be suffering and not let you know. You realize only when they get suddenly ill. They're private animals. When they know they're going to die, they want to sneak away from the house into the woods. They have their own strange dignity. And they're very resilient up until that point. Probably dogs can, too. They can go without eating for quite a while if they're trapped, and perhaps people can as well. I've noticed that you often write about experiences women have that only other women really understand, and the same for men. You've suggested that, quote, there is a mysterious and terrible brotherhood of men by way of violence, end quote, one that excludes women. In Babysitter, you write, quote, the curse of a female to so badly need love, end quote. And, quote, a man's hunger less personal and particular than in a woman, end quote. There are a lot of moments like this. Are you channeling Hannah here? You seem to have strong views about the masculine and the feminine. Well, I don't know that those are my particular views. They're relevant to the novel. Hannah is a certain kind of person. I'm a philosophical writer. I'm interested in ideas and themes. I can dramatize an idea that I don't believe in myself. People don't seem to understand that. If you're a novelist, you basically like characters and different personalities, so each personality may have his or her own gravitas and convictions. And they may not be at all the same. And so they have a kind of adversarial relationship. But I think a novelist who is sympathetic with her characters will make all the characters seem believable. I wrote a novel, A Book of American Martyrs, which looks at both sides of the division in America, between anti-abortion people and the liberals or the abortion providers. I wanted it to be symmetrical, balanced. When you're reading about the anti-abortion evangelicals, you are reading about sincere people. They really believe these things. They believe in God. They believe in Christ. They believe in a sanctity of the fetus. They believe that a fetus is a soul, and they believe in souls. On the other side, you have people who are agnostic or secular. They don't believe there is a soul or a God. When you're a novelist, you want to give all sides of a subject to make it more like life. But the quote about violence creates a mysterious and terrible brotherhood of men, though, was from a piece of nonfiction. I think you were writing as yourself. That's boxing. Oh, I don't think all men are unified or bonded in violence. Boxing celebrates male violence and self-sacrifice. Now, there are women boxers. When I was writing about boxing, women boxers weren't that prominent. I wouldn't say all men are violent, but when you're writing a piece of creative nonfiction, you might overstate things. As I said, I'm a philosophical writer. I examine propositions and ideas. What I might have examined in 1981 or 2003 is not necessarily what I believe now, but these are propositions that somebody believes. I'm not writing propaganda from one point of view. As a novelist, I'm interested in the drama of life, I think, and in seeing how different personalities play out. Shakespeare is this supreme dramatist, and you wouldn't necessarily say that Shakespeare is Hamlet, that Shakespeare is or is not Macbeth. He's all of those people, but he's also none of them. You could argue that there was something of Shakespeare in Iago, but I would identify more with somebody like Shakespeare than I would with a polemical novelist. I'm more interested in a dramatization of conflict. And now, from the November 7th, 2022 issue of The New Yorker, a poem by Joyce Carol Oates, The Wishbone. In the still of night, old fears emerge. Those closest relatives you'd found barely bearable. Cornucopias of family dystopia spilling into amusing anecdotes decades later, like a much-thumbed rosary or litany of the dead. Old vexations, tics, and mannerisms wincing at the pinch of the drunk uncle, so handsome but died young. Stooping to avoid the hacking cough, soon to propel your Hungarian grandfather to his grave. Those years, pride redacts the grave, long heartbreak of loving the one more than he'd loved you, who'd favored your sister and not you, who at 12 rolled your eyes, such boredom, jaws wrenched in yawns. At Thanksgiving, twinge of nausea, clammy white turkey carcass and skin, stink of eviscerated gut, and in the gravy boat, coarse curdles of grease, Pope's nose, giblets and innards, wishbone carefully removed from the ravaged skeleton and perched atop the fridge to dry, forgotten and forlorn, until rediscovered in December, brittle and easily broken. Make a wish, Joyce. But what could you have possibly wished so young? To be older? To be out of there? To be where? Stunned now to recall how all at that table are gone now, mere ectoplasm in a dim region of the brain. How heedless you'd love them, after all, as they'd loved whoever it was you. That's all the time we have today for The New Yorker. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you very much for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.